You are listening to the Zen Nova Scotia podcast with talks by Cone France. These talks are made possible in part by generous donations from our listeners. To find out how to support and take part in our community, visit zennovascotia.com.
The fifth precept, it's the last in what I would call the universal precepts. The first five are among the traditions that hold the precepts. Everybody has some version of these five, and then it gets more interesting. So we're at the end of the basics. And perhaps the place to start is to acknowledge that we can't talk about the fifth precept in the way that people used to talk about the fifth precept, for lots of reasons. We say not trafficking in alcohol or not indulging in alcohol in its original. Any thinking person can recognize that limiting this to alcohol doesn't make sense. There are lots of things like alcohol. So we usually say intoxicants, not trafficking in intoxicants, not indulging in intoxicants. But then, even in my lifetime, the way that we understand that has changed. The stigma around certain kinds of substances in my lifetime has changed. But also, and this is a place where I want to kind of focus tonight, the stigma around addiction has changed. So it used to be that someone who had kind of succumbed in their relationship to something like alcohol or to other illicit drugs or to something psychotropic was not only a failure, but they were a morally bad person. And we have the good fortune of living in an era when we don't see it that way. Of course, some people do. But I think we understand today that addiction is a disease. That, to me, is a very useful thing to keep coming back to as we think about this question of our relationship to intoxicants. But to back up a minute, what is an intoxicant? The fact is that everything alters our minds. Right, and I've mentioned that I've had meals that left me high. I can't blame how I felt on anything else. I ingested something so good that it changed my feeling about the world for about an hour. Right, there was nothing illegal in the risotto. It was just that good. Right. If you've ever been in love, you know that process, those days, those hours, those weeks affect the way that you see everything. Everything. And similarly, for some people, winter in the other way affects how they see everything. A rainy day affects how they see everything. And just like this question of addiction, we can start by acknowledging a couple of things. One, that this doesn't mean you're particularly weak. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. If you don't feel your absolute best today when it's raining and it's dark, that isn't a failure in you. It means that you're organic. You're made of matter. And you're affected by the things of the world. You can just be honest about that. But part of that honesty is not just, you know, giving yourself a break. It's beginning this process of noticing what affects you and how. I've said this before as well. I have the experience. I've had the experience many times, and I will have it again, of thinking, you know, somewhere around noon, man, I just don't feel good today. Why? What's wrong? Am I getting sick? Did something happen? Right? I'll start going through conversations that I had. Did somebody say something that maybe affected me in a way that I didn't consciously register at the time, but now if I were to go back and pick through every single word, would I find the thing that kind of hurt me or caused me distress? And then I will look out the window and see that it's raining. And I'll think, oh, right. Is that the entire story? Maybe, maybe not. Is it part of the story? Almost definitely. Starting to be honest in that way is fundamental. Right? Almost every corner of this tradition tells us that we need to examine our minds. This precept is really pointing to that in a number of ways. But the other thing that we need to be honest about from the beginning, or clear about, is that as soon as we start talking about intoxication, we come to this question that we've discussed many times before, this assumption or this often unconscious belief that we have a baseline, that there's a me that is neutral, right? There's a me that isn't affected by the weather or by anything I ate or by any conversation I've had in the last week. There's a me that's untouched by regret or optimism or cynicism. That's my baseline. That's how I feel unaffected by something else. And now the problem is I'm going to go take something and that thing is going to change that. And now I'm not really me anymore. Right? We say, oh, that's the alcohol talking. Hmm? That's not you talking. No, it's you talking. And right now there's alcohol. This is you with alcohol. This is you without alcohol. This is you on a sunny day. This is you on a rainy day. We can do this forever, and we never find the baseline you. The baseline is a myth, right? So we can let go of some idea of purity around this, right? Some idea that we could follow this and be completely clean, and our minds could be completely clean. They can't, because everything touches everything, and that includes you. So first we throw that out. Once we've done that, then we come back to this question of what is an intoxicant. It's not useful to say it's everything. If it's a precept, it's not useful to say that it's everything. So I'm going to offer up that an intoxicant is something we turn to because we want our mind changed. We don't want to feel this way. Or maybe we want to feel that way. We don't want to think this way, or maybe we want to think that way. And so we make a choice. From there, it's interesting. Because what are we choosing? Everything is touching our mind. But that can just be very interesting. If I served you all tea right now, and it was laced with a little something, right? But I didn't tell you, you would all have a very interesting experience. Not one that you'd chosen. It wouldn't be an event in which you chose to not feel the way you're feeling. You would suddenly just discover something. So, oh. And if you are taking up this practice of examining your mind, it might be kind of fascinating. In the same way that when you're at a party and you suddenly meet someone to whom you're deeply attracted. That's also really interesting. You can watch all these things happening in your brain, right? It doesn't mean you have to act on any of them. It doesn't mean that they mean anything. But you can observe it. You say, look at that, I stand a little differently when I'm around someone who kind of catches my eye. Huh, look at that. Or I say dumb things, right? Why did I say that? I wouldn't say that to anyone else, and yet I said it to that person. Huh. It's just an education. It's just another day in the life. Where I think this becomes really juicy, and I'm going to use addiction a little bit loosely here, is this question of addiction. The Buddhism would tell us already, we're all addicts, right? We're all addicted to an idea about who we are, for example. We all have something that we can't easily let go of, even if we think we should. But in relationship to this particular set of questions, there are states of mind that we want, right? Some of those are probably, I won't say universal, but they're very common, right? Feeling inspired. Almost everybody wants to feel inspired. And if they see an opportunity, if they see something that they think might take them there, they might trip over themselves to get to that place, right? People want to feel confident. They want to feel these things. But of course, there's another version of this life in which some people are addicted to feeling bad, right? It feeds their narrative to believe that things are their fault, for example, that they're culpable in everything. And so instead of kind of grasping for something that feels good when they don't feel good, they'll notice that they're feeling good and they'll start grasping for that thing that allows them to feel bad and heavy. Because in a kind of inverted way, that's what feels right. But it's the same thing. Most of the time, most of us would like to feel a little bit differently from how we feel right now. At least a little bit. And it's only accentuated by the fact that very occasionally we might feel great. We get a hit of something, some moment of release. And then that becomes a kind of signpost about wanting to feel that way all the time. So we seek states of mind. And one of the greatest dangers of Buddhism in general and Zen perhaps in particular is that we can come to it with the idea that it is a tool for achieving a certain state of mind, right? If I practice Zen, I will start to feel a certain way. I'll start to see in a particular way. And that will be true, or it will feel good. It will feel authentic. That is unbelievably seductive. And I would offer up, just false. You can manufacture it. If you want Zen practice to make you feel a particular way, the placebo effect of your own mind can get you halfway there. Because you can convince yourself that whenever you meditate, you feel like this. Right? Bowing feels like this. When I sit up a little bit straighter and I put on my Zen hat, I feel like this. That's just more grasping It's an intoxicant. It's seeking after a state of mind that is not this one. As if this one is somehow lacking. As if this one is less authentic. As if this one is wrong. I don't want to tell you that you should convince yourself that the way you feel right now feels good. Or that you couldn't feel better. Or that it's wrong to want to feel happy. But if in this moment you don't feel happy, and this is so hard, it is possible to accept that without resting in the gap between how you actually feel and how you think you should. It is possible to accept that without seeking or manufacturing something that will change it somehow, because this way of being isn't quite right. And like all things, to a degree, this is maturity. I have kids, and I see how unacceptable bad feelings are to them. Right? When something hurts, there's no context for things that hurt. Everything hurts. The world hurts, right? When they're sad, the world is sad. And it's not okay. It's not acceptable. Most of us, to a degree, just because we've been through so much as human beings, we give ourselves a little bit of leeway. We're able to notice that we don't feel great. We don't necessarily panic, right? But we do start looking, right? We start grabbing. Sometimes in a curious way and sometimes in a desperate way. And for some people, of course, that leads to what this whole precept was originally about. It leads to actually reaching out to something, to some external substance, and saying, I'm going to take that. But I think that's a small part. That's kind of the extreme. The subtler version of this is that we have things that distract us from how we feel right now. Which, by the way, is all alcohol can do. You can spend a few hours with it. You have to come back to something. Now we live in the most distracted age ever. And I'll take this opportunity because it's so important to recognize, and we, this is, again, one of the benefits of this age, is that we understand something about how to treat addiction. We understand something about the process. The first step is to admit it, right? The first step is to start noticing the things that you can't quite let go of. That might be certain fantasies. It might be certain memories. It might be certain regrets or certain hopes. Or it might be stuff. I, by any legal definition, am addicted to my phone. It sounds dramatic to say that because I'm not the most addicted. You know, I'm not holding it right now. I've met people who are on a different part of that spectrum. And yet, it does to me what it does to everybody. Right? Whatever 30 years of Zen practice has not made me transcend this incredible technology that wants my attention. So I put it down on the counter. But if I see the little light for a second, that means something happened. Right? Someone communicated with me. That's incredibly inviting. It isn't that I believe it's going to be good. In fact, often I sigh when I see it. Because, oh, Why can't they leave me alone? I say to myself, and then I walk over and I check it. Because I have to know, right? I've reduced on my phone now down to only email anything that has a red circle with a number in it. What could be more enticing than that, right? This too is about intoxication. Not on a grand scale. Not in a sense of getting lost. It's microdosing, right? There's this little hit that I get. It satisfies something, but more importantly, it leaves me wanting more of it. When I first started writing a blog, it almost killed me. Because part of having a blog is that you get all the stats. So you get alerts, and there's a machine out there that's telling you you're having a good day. And then you, what kind of good day am I having? And then you'll check, and then it'll tell you how many people in each country in the world are looking at what you wrote today. And what are they saying about it? And who's sharing it with whom? Right? These are drugs that the Buddha could never have conceived of. Ever. And they're in the hands of all of us. And not only that, we tell each other, you have to have these. It's important that you have these. You can't actually function. You can't really hold down a job if you don't participate in this. If you aren't a little bit addicted to this, right? You'll do better in your work if you get excited by the red dot. And anything short of that looks like apathy instead of maturity. I don't believe that there's anything in this practice that transcends addiction. I don't think there's anything about this practice that takes us to a state of mind where none of these things affect us anymore. That would be great. But we're human. And having that little thing beep on your phone is like having it rain outside. But what it does do is it invites us to look closely at how we relate to these things. Specifically at the degree to which that relationship is unconscious. And we're invited then to make it conscious. So that when we take something up, it's a choice that's held responsibly instead of a kind of sleepwalking where we check in and then we realize we did it after. This precept is especially suited to this moment. I think. I'll just say one more thing, which is that I was listening to someone, so an interview about this. You know, there's a moment in advertising when it shifted. When it shifted from information about a product to a kind of manipulation. And then there was another shift that happened where we started to realize that we could consciously shape people's patterns, right? Not just entice them by making things pretty or using powerful language, but we could kind of find their pleasure centers and start poking them there. It's an amazing time to be alive. And I don't think we can win. But we can be honest. And I'll stop there.
For more information about Zen, our practice, and how you can support and take part in our community, please visit zennovascotia.com.